Hello, I'm Arnold Hamilton, editor of the Oklahoma Observer.
And I'm Marianne Martin, and this is ObserverCast, your weekly deep dive into Oklahoma politics and policy, powered by the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation.
The House Speaker and the Senate President pro tem are in a pitched public squabble over education spending, including plans to create a voucher program that threatens to rob already underfunded Oklahoma public schools of hundreds of millions of dollars. So far, the histrionics have been comical. Senate President Greg Treat called House Speaker Charles McCall's rhetoric asinine. But we can't let it obscure the reality of what's happening here. The House Speaker, the Senate President, and the Governor all want vouchers. And both houses of the legislature already have given their approval, albeit with different approaches to steering public tax dollars into private, religious, and/or for-profit schools, even cutting homeschool parents a check from the state treasury. All point to a potentially cataclysmic final 2 months of the legislature for those who believe the genius of America is its public schools, which welcome all comers, regardless of socioeconomic status, race, religion, abilities, or disabilities. To help us unpack the all-out assault on Oklahoma's K-12 schools, we invited Tulsa Senator Joanna Dossett to join us for this week's ObserverCast. She's seen what's at stake from both the classroom and the legislative floor. We always like to begin by asking our guests to tell everybody who they are and a little bit about themselves. So, Senator Dossett, would you weigh in here to get started?
Absolutely. This is Senator Joanna Dossett, representing Senate District 35 here in Midtown Tulsa. I am in my third session of my first term in the legislature, and feeling now as if I'm in the middle of my first big House and Senate showdown. There may have been showdowns that went on my first two legislative sessions, but I probably wasn't even aware of them. Now this year, my third year, I know everything that's going on, know where the bathrooms are, know where my parking spot is, and am really in tune to everything that's swirling around the Capitol. But I will say, this I think is a particularly big showdown that's happening, having to do with the big education package and a whole bunch of good things and bad things kind of hanging in the balance. But happy to be serving as the voice of Midtown Tulsa in the Senate on all these issues we're deliberating these days.
I don't want you to short sell yourself. I think you might also add the voice of reason in this, so we might.
Absolutely.
we might include that. I will say that my experience, this is highly unusual to have the Speaker of the House and the Senate President essentially negotiating or lobbying Molotov cocktails, however you want to. It's not often the Senate President calls the House Speaker's ideas asinine, but, you know, and if it weren't such a serious issue, I'd get the popcorn popping and just sit back and enjoy the show. But I think the reality here is, in spite of all the theatrics, you have a situation where both the House and the Senate now have given lopsided approval to a voucher scheme. And at the end of the day, that leads one to believe that they may very well come to some kind of agreement before it's all said and done, because the notion is just too appealing.
I couldn't have said it any better. If we were dealing with issues that were less serious, if we were dealing with issues that had less to do with really the future of our state, that would be one thing. But we are talking about, and I will agree with you, we're talking about the newest, latest voucher scheme. And it looks like some form of voucher is going to come out of this, this negotiation, this battle, this warfare, whatever is going on.
Can you recap for us basically what the
proposals on the table are right now. There's coverage out there, but I think just so, you know, we can acquaint the listeners with what's actually out there.
Absolutely. So we've got two bills, House Bill 1935 and House Bill 2775. Short history, those two bills appeared literally overnight, a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, on the House side. Speaker McCaul is the author and really the force behind these two bills. They did not have a proper policy committee hearing. They didn't go through an education committee. They went straight to A and B, straight to appropriations. Mm-hmm. The members of that committee, it's a pretty large committee, bipartisan one, with a lot of former educators on it. Your folks who often identify as pro public ed members, whichever party they're in. But anyway, those members didn't have very much time to read the bills that they were questioning and debating that day. I remember running over there from my Senate business that day to try to catch the end of that meeting. Anyway, the bills passed appropriations with some bipartisan opposition. It was not a a party line aye or nay on the two bills. Then the two bills had a very lengthy floor hearing over in the House. Forget which day it was, but once again, ran over there as fast as I could after my Senate business was done that day. And they had a very long, very lengthy, really arduous hearing. And once again, passed. The opposition wasn't party line voting on the passage of these two bills. The one bill pretty much, I'm gonna fast forward a little bit. Monday of this week that we just got through. Very odd thing happened. There were three Senate committees that were scheduled all at the same time, all in the same room. Education, finance, and appropriations. Same time, same room, one bill presentation for 1935 and one bill presentation for 2775. And then all the members of the three committees posed their questions and offered their debate. We know that was an effort to fast track the bills and get them through committee and get them on the floor this Thursday that just passed. The votes on the Senate committee side did go down partisan lines. Democrats mm-hmm. voting nay. On 1935, Republicans voting aye. 2775 gained some Democratic support, mine included, and talk about that a little bit more later. But anyway, they both handily passed. But the big part was they weren't in the same condition as they were. They weren't the same language as they were when they came over to us, the Senate, from the House. So 1935 is a bill that provides for tax credits for private school tuition and expenses incurred during homeschooling. Senate made it slightly better, in my opinion, by placing an income cap on 1935. The cap, in my opinion, was much too high, though. We've got an income cap of $250,000 that families can bring home annually and still have access to $7,500 per child for private school tuition, and then $1,000 per child for homeschool expenses. Interestingly, these credits can actually come in the form of cash advances to correspond with, the schedule for tuition payment, fall semester, spring semester. It's remarkable to me that we can say in these bills that a family of making $250,000 a year, not only are we going to give them help, $7,500 a kid for private school tuition, but also we're going to offer that in the form of a cash advance. So there we go on 1935, passed Senate Education, Finance, and Appropriations Committee handily. 2775. The companion bill The intent of the authors, you know, behind all these bills is that they pass together, not one without the other. 2775 increases the minimum salary schedule. So that's the teacher pay raise portion. And it increases it, you know, for years, number of years, you know, in teaching, also different categories of teacher, you know, teachers with master's degrees or teachers with national board certification, all will experience bumps according to the adjusted salary schedule, adjusted minimum salary schedule. It also funds the per pupil weighted funding formula. So puts money into education on a per pupil basis in the funding formula that we already have. The contentious part of 2775, which lost it a couple of Democratic votes, one vote on education committee and two votes on appropes, is the merit pay program that it institutes up to $30 million in the form of like a grant that a school district can receive if they implement a merit pay program that is largely determined by the and approved by the local school board. I had previously voted against that as a standalone measure, and many of us on the Senate Democratic caucus had voted against that as a standalone measure. But then as a part of the whole, including teacher pay raises via the salary schedule and funding the per pupil funding formula, we were okay with that compromise, and some of us voted for it. Interestingly, that merit pay initiative, that merit pay language, kind of came to us through a fishy process too. It never got a proper education committee hearing because it was language inserted into a gutted bill that appeared on the floor one day during deadline week. And for that reason, Senate Democratic Caucus voted against it just because of that. You know, you can't implement something like that as a standalone measure that really just kind of cropped up overnight with no committee vetting. But then, like I said, a few of us went ahead and voted for it as part of the overall, you know, set of initiatives in 2775. There you go. Both those bills passed the floor handily. In a very interesting, and I'll go ahead and even say kind of sad moment, we lost the rurals. We just lost them. For, you know, at the Capitol, there very much is that urban rural divide that you hear about. It really exists at the Capitol. But interestingly, historically, that divide has not existed when it comes to public school funding. Our rural legislators, along with our urban legislators, and I'm one of them, often come together, rally together around that issue of defunding public schools, because we both know rurals and urbans, when you start defunding public schools, I mean, that's, we're both in kind of the same hurt there. Our schools and our kids are gonna lose when you start with the defunding. But interestingly, we lost every single rural, you know, member, both in committee and on the floor. I thought, okay, well, maybe this is a committee move. Maybe they've agreed to, you know, to help this bill through committee, but they're gonna vote their conscience, vote their district on the floor, but it didn't happen. And so to me, when we lost the rurals on 1935, it's almost kind of an end of an era sort of feeling for me. Like, where's the resistance anymore? Is there going to be any more resistance to these defunding voucher and voucher-like measures? So there you go.
So
kind of the story of last week.
Yeah. So I wonder then, since this is really because I mean that is a momentous moment, right? You know, when you see that rural blockade, you know, the firewall against vouchers disappear. But in the backdrop, it's what happened last year when Treat's bill went down, and you saw, you know, how punitive he was, you know, Senator Treat was in response. But then also that the Speaker McCall throwing the gauntlet down and saying, do not send this back to me with amendments. You know, so it just really seems like it was more of a political message that had nothing to do with education, maybe. It was more about you can't push the Senate around, right? Like, that's a really terrible way to kind of regurgitate what's going on. But I mean, really playing with fire.
Oh, yeah. I love the imagery there of the rural blockade. Yeah.
That I mean,
together our rurals and then our very few urbans mm-hmm. together mm-hmm. Over the last, well, up until now, have been an effective defense against whatever you want to call it, scholarships, vouchers, tax credits. It all goes to funneling money away from public ed.
So it makes me wonder then. So, you know, Speaker McCall started softening his language after it got through the Senate with the amendment. So, you know, after that, it was no longer, well, hell no. But, you know, for it to pass, it's got to come back to his chamber. And he is like the representative of rural schools, right? You know, I mean, he could stop this. So now it's like, okay, I don't know. I just wonder, you know, was it all kind of a facade? You know, was it kind of a ruse? Or do they really see what's online, that, you know, what the stakes are to get this initiative passed, since they really have two dueling, you know, propositions for school vouchers? I don't know. Mm-hmm.
I have wondered, kind of in another way to interpret this, I wonder if last week wasn't mostly showbiz.
Yeah.
Wasn't mostly performative.
Yeah.
In order to kind of hold space or hold time, or, you know, keep folks captivated while deals are being worked out mm-hmm. privately in rooms where I'm not, where most of us aren't. But I don't know. Taking everything at its face value, and, you know, assuming positive intent and transparent intent all around, I would say now to the House, it's, you know, rural House members, it's on you now. There's going to be that small number of urbans who will likely be against what they see. But I think rural House members have a very important and perhaps even powerful part to play here. I think we kind of covered this, not so much on 2775. There's not much disagreement about 2775. It's money to schools, it's 1935, where all the, you know, I think where all that energy is going to be focused on hammering out whatever the deal is, or not arriving at a deal. And I think rural House members right now play a very important part.
Well, and you think about too, the fact that they're pushing both of these through together, you know, as a package, you know, a dagger. It's just, you don't need both. You know, you really don't need both. You really only need one. You need the teacher pay raise. Yeah, you need the teacher pay raise. Absolutely, full stop. You don't need this voucher bill, right? And so, but I also think it's interesting too that now that mysterious $700 million has freed up because of all the, you know, Volkswagen falling through, Panasonic falling through, all the falling throughs. Now we have this nice little bucket of money that needs appropriated.
Right.
Yeah, but the problem with that is that when the next economic downturn comes, and it will come, we will have walked ourselves into these tax credits, which, as we know, are really not tax credits. They're tax expenditures is what they are. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you're stuck with those. You'll never be able to repeal those tax credits.
Right.
We have them for good. There is, if we get them, yeah, we're going to have them. There's part of 1935 that says what to do in cases of revenue failure, or in cases of money to public schools ever being decreased, that there would be a corresponding decrease in the tax credits. And my question is, if we're experiencing revenue failure, why would we ever keep implementing this credit, this expenditure? Mm-hmm. Why would it not be an automatic, just a trigger to stop it automatically? But they're really, I think you're right, Arnold, they're building it in so that we're going to have it forever and there won't be any way to get rid of it. We'll be stuck with it even during our down years, our low years.
And forgive me too, because I remember past legislatures building in, when Democrats were in control, I will add, just so Republicans will not accuse me of this being a totally partisan thing.
Right.
But I remember legislatures writing into law when we got pari-mutuel wagering on horse races, when we got, you know, gambling and all kinds of things, that certain amounts of money would go to public ed, and if public ed's money got decreased, you know, then things would increase in other areas. And they never did. They never did make public education whole on these things. And I just think that's an empty line that makes it look like they're being proactive and thinking ahead, but they're really not. And they can't bind future legislatures to that.
Well, I mean, and that's what they have a history of doing too, right? Like what they're doing this year, they're pairing any sort of revenue any sort of pay increase with a regressive policy, like, you know, so-called vouchers, tax credits, whatever you want to call them. So it's never, you know, like Representative Ranson is saying, it's never a clean pay raise. You know, they got to do one, they got to do the other.
That's interesting. That's I think the House Democrats developed a statement or coalesced around a statement or a plan in it. Yeah, that clean pay raise. That's a very interesting way to put it. And no, that's not what we're doing now. We're doing a really complicated, messy, kind of fraught with problems pay raise is what we're doing. And we don't need to, like you said before, we shouldn't have to do this. Yeah, we just need one of these bills.
Yeah. we do have a history of breaking promises to teachers in public schools, and we need to look no further than the National Board Certified Teacher Program to see, you know, right, to see promises being broken. You know, one thing that's really interesting to me, and I want to give props out to the NBC affiliate here in Oklahoma City, KFOR, because they did some reporting yesterday that really caught my eye. And I guess I didn't fully appreciate some of the details in this legislation. But, you know, it sounded like when the president pro tem put the $250,000 income cap on the voucher program, it sounded like, well, you know, okay, there are lots of people who make, you know, who make a fair amount of money in this state. So at least it doesn't, you know, it would protect us against the fattest of the fat cats collecting on this deal. But they broke it down, and I just wanted to share this and see what you're thinking is about this. That if you had a household income of $250,000 and you had two kids in private schools, you'd be eligible for $15,000 in tax credits each year, okay? Now, on that $250,000, the typical family would pay around $10,822 in state income taxes. So that means that the state not only would, put $15,000 into their kids' private school education, but the state would then also cut them a check for $4,178 to make up that full $15,000 amount, because their taxable burden is only $10,822. And it's similar, it's even more dramatic if you're looking at a family making $100,000 a year with two kids in private school, you know, qualifying for the $15,000 in vouchers. Their income tax burden would generally be about $3,700. Well, the state would then send them a check for the difference, which is $11,300. I mean, think about it. I mean, you're collecting a check from the state on this deal.
It's highway robbery.
Who's the moochers now, right? Yeah.
And this is to add speechless,
to really. I've seen some crazy things in my years of covering legislatures in Oklahoma and Texas and California, but this may be the topper.
Along that line, and this a potential situation would apply to fewer families and kids. But say you're a family who's already receiving the Lindsay Nicole Henry scholarship, which we in the Senate have very recently worked on expanding to kids who do not even have a demonstrated or documented disability. You can stack those. So we're now making all these programs stackable. And that is outrageous to me, the amount of money that a single family could walk home with when we're trying to educate the rest of the 700,000 kids that need educating in a school system that we're now actively trying to take funding away from because of these programs.
So is it possible, though? I don't know if this is silver lining or just hopeful thinking, but is it possible that they can, you know, the Republicans in the legislature can talk all this game about, you know, parent choice, when it turns out there's really not the market out there, right? Like, there's only so many schools that that can accept. There's not bandwidth for some, you know, even nowhere near that, the kids that they think will take these.
I mean, I don't know if we actually even know what private school capacity is.
Like, they don't have to tell us, right?
No, you know, they have to tell us. It could be that we get this, we put this program into place, and Oklahoma parents and families continue to keep choosing their public schools, like most of them, like most of us do, and that this as a loss of revenue, this isn't as big as we thought it might be. But the problem is, we just don't know, and we're writing it in a statute, and we're never going to be able, as Arnold stated before, we're never going to be able to get rid of it.
You know, and I just think of, we lived in Dallas for a number of years, and I think of the private school, like, industry that's down there, right? I mean, and these are like religious affiliated, non-religious affiliated, but there are just bumper crops of private schools in the DFW Metroplex, I'm sure throughout Texas, even though there are these amazing public schools, throughout the same area. So there's a lot of demand, but I just really wonder, like, what demand will actually be, because I'm not sure that a lot of parents are really like, oh yeah, now I can send my kid to Heritage Hall. You know, like, that's where they need to go, you know. Like, I just don't know that you're gonna really see, like, I don't think it's like not this really pernicious, you know, piece of policy. It's just terrible, right? It's terrible what it says about what they're willing to do to the public school system. But I'm just like, I was, so kind of as an aside, like, there was the author or the editor of the 1619 Project, right? She was tweeting about how, I think she still lives in New York City, although she has her project down at Howard University now. But anyways, she was tweeting about how her daughter and her friend and their friends were supposed to study for this exam that gives them entrance into these highly selective public schools, I guess, in New York City. And they did the numbers, and they crunched the math, and they did some research, and they're like, well, Black kids just don't get accepted regardless of our test scores, so we're just not going to bother, you know. And I just kind of wonder, like, I don't know. I mean, this is maybe the fatalistic worst way to look at this, but I just wonder, you know, if at the end of the day, there's going to be parents out there who's like, you know what, I still can't cover the cost. I still don't think it's, you know, I just don't know who's going to be out there and be like, yeah, Cassidy, we can do that now, you know. You know, I don't know that I don't know, we'll see, because otherwise I don't know what it's for, you know.
You know, there's no, that reminded me of how in the bills as it's written, 1935, there's no data collection. There's no tracking. There's no, you know, and if we really thought that this was a problem that this could solve, that these tax credits could solve, we might conduct a study. There might be an interim study. There might be a measure that we pass to say,
some
hey,
research.
We're gonna, with some research somewhere. We're going to track how many parents, if when given the chance to access one of these vouchers, do make it. But no, we're not doing any of that. No.
You know, and you know, we don't have a State Department of Education that cares to validate any of this either. So, you know,
it's not even functioning.
I was just going to say it's not, I don't know how functional it is right now.
I mean,
at the moment.
to even expect them, I mean, you know, they're not going to try and promulgate rules or, you know, that would make this accountable or, I just wonder if somehow it's going to butt up against some federal violation.
I remember during Senator Boren's debate, she referred a couple of times to separate and unequal systems that we were setting up here. I thought that was so beautifully, subtly, beautifully stated.
Ultimately, this could become a civil rights issue.
You mentioned earlier the 1619 project. Yeah, we don't talk about that in the legislature. The legislature I can talk about it with you here. The legislature by and large doesn't recognize any systemic forces at work in society. It's just you and your bootstraps. And that's what's going to solve your problems. If you're poor, it's because you're not working hard enough and you're somehow morally inferior to the rest of us. There's no acknowledgement whatsoever about any type of systemic force that might make something hard for one person that isn't hard for another.
And so, of course, you know, these kids coming from the poor parts of town are going to have no problem getting into these, you know, highly affluent private schools. I mean, that's not going to be a problem at all.
No,
or getting transported to them every day.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And during the questioning, we started a little bit in committee and then really hammered on the floor about the $250,000 income cap. The bill author just kept going on and on that this is for kids who, you know, are born in the wrong zip code. This is for kids who have trouble access. This is for kids who are trapped. This is for kids who are in failing, all this stuff. And to me, okay, that means maybe the household income is 30,000 or 40,000 a year. And you know, bill author agreed. Yep, that's who we're targeting. Okay, well then why does it say 250,000? Bill author got a little sensitive about why we kept harping on the 250,000. He didn't want to talk about the 250,000. The problem is it's there. It's there in language. So we're gonna need to talk about it.
Then by that logic, the enrollment cap into Sooner Care should be $250,000.
Right.
And OLAP should be pegged to $250,000 as well. If that's our metric and that's our benchmark, then let's set it all, because you know what? That our family would qualify. I mean, just like, if that's the benchmark for kids that are needy, well then.
Yep.
Here's these other programs that should qualify as well.
Then we asked, where did it come from? Where'd the $250,000 come from? And I think the answer was something like that was the number that could garner the votes. That was not joking. That was one of the answers. Well, that was the number we needed to get the votes we needed to pass the bill.
But we know where that got pulled out of. We just don't know whose that got pulled out of, I guess. So back to the rural caucus for just a minute. What's your theory about what changed here? Because there certainly are not private schools available out there. Now, there may be a lot of evangelical churches in rural Oklahoma that say, hey, you know, we could set up a school here and cash in on that income from the taxpayers. But, you know, if that doesn't happen, where are those kids going to get educated out there?
I'm not sure. And, you know, I didn't talk too much when I was going over the kind of the bill history a little bit. the versions that came over from the House, the 1935, which came over from the House, was a lot more friendly to rural legislators in that help me a little bit here if I get it wrong, but anyway, there was money invested into the system, not through the weighted per pupil funding formula, some other avenue, and it put a cap on how much money could go to each school district, a $2 million cap. And that was going to hurt every 5A, every 6A, every urban district, and it was going to disproportionately benefit rural districts.
But the idea was, and this is where you can see, I think, rural legislators buying into this.
Yep.
A lot of the urban districts, you know, the Edmonds, the Normans, the Jinxes, the Broken Arrows, you know, all the Owassos, all, you know, they have this property tax base that rural Oklahoma doesn't have in Southern Maine because we give too many tax credits to agriculture, among other things. But, you know, that was going to actually accrue to the benefit of rural schools for a change. Yep.
And so, although I didn't agree with it, I'm an urban, you know, I represent an urban school district, I'm an urban senator.
But there's logic there.
There was logic there. I kind of, it kind of felt a little bit like a buyout, a little bit. Yeah. But anyway, I didn't agree with it, but I understood it. Oh, okay. Well, we lost the rurals here. They did it. They finally like thread that needle or kind of like found that sweet spot of where they could get the rurals on their side. And I understood it. But when Senate amended that out, I don't know. I didn't ask any of my rural colleagues. Maybe it was just all too kind of raw or emotional. I don't know. But the question in my mind was, but for what, how did this deserve your yes vote? What was in it? You know, in 2775, there is an increased weight for transportation. I do know that rural school districts run a whole lot more bus miles than your suburbans and urbans do. So there was a nod given there to money that rural districts need for transportation. But still, I can't think of one thing in that entire package, those two bills that would have guaranteed a rural yes. At least some more vigorous questioning, you know, at least some more vigorous debate.
Are they counting on it dying when it gets back to the House, I wonder?
Yeah, I don't know. So that's, we were saying earlier, I think it might perhaps be the time for rural House members to exercise their full power here. I can't see anything that's in the Senate version that would make it worth a rural yes. I just can't see it.
Well, I mean, because we don't know that it will be heard at all when it goes back to the House, you know, because then Treat's bill, I'm sorry, what's its status in the House?
It's so the two, the still 1935 and 2775, okay. Right? So they both, they've both been, you know, past the Senate floor and grossed back in the House, and we're waiting to see what House does with them. We'll see. I really have no idea. I have no idea. The unfortunate part, though, and maybe for some people that's exciting, for other people that's frustrating. It's not a great way to use the people's time. This back and forth, this ping pong. But really, right now, it's the end of March. It's the beginning of April. Teachers are deciding if they're going to go back to work next year. Teachers are deciding if they're going to be teachers again next year. They're looking, they're hunting, they're figuring out if they're going to stay put, if they're going to leave, if they're going to change school districts, change professions, stay home. And this doesn't create an atmosphere of stability or assurance.
I think it was Claudia Swisher that tweeted, she goes, so this is how they're going to kill.
Yeah.
This is how they're going to kill the teacher pay raise.
Kind of quiet. This is how they're going to kill it. And it's just sort of be like, maybe like this quiet dying sort of.
And then they can just point fingers at each other. Well, it was their fault. It was their fault. I mean,
yeah. And there's, you know, teachers, there's not a big walkout going on at the Capitol. I might suggest that there's probably a slow, steady walkout, just walking out of the classroom.
Yeah.
Happening.
I have two kids in the school system, public schools. If their teachers leave, they should, right? I mean,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. My kid stacked up with 50, 60 kids in a class in her, you know, in our Norman public schools. Well, that's just what we deserve because, I mean,
yep.
it sucks, but you know,
you cannot live and pay your bills on your love for those children.
No, that doesn't pay bills. Nobody should. No. Nobody should, you know,
should and can't. And
nobody,
and, yeah.
Right. Nobody should be disrespected that way. Nobody should. And I mean, but the problem is my kids will be okay because they have parents at home that can supplement their education. Right. There's not every kid that's like that. So that does suck. But teachers, if they, I'd be like, I'm out. I don't blame them at all. I don't blame them at all. You know, go. No. You have been so disrespected. They were a pawn in a game. I'd be curious to see what happens to Crete spill over in the house.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I think I said earlier, and this wasn't part of our questioning and debate because we were, Senate Democrats, we were, we were against the bill. I will say if you want to talk about kind of the Senate House rivalry going on, well, yes, it was made better. The Senate did make it better. It had no income cap. Mm-hmm. So there is an income cap there, but Speaker McCaul said, I don't want any changes. And there's pretty big changes there. So we'll see what happens. Interestingly, and I think we kind of touched on this a little earlier. Speaker McCaul was a backstop in a different way. Last year, he said, I'm not here in 1647, which was the voucher bill, the all out voucher bill that we spoke about earlier. And that embarrassing display that happened during its floor hearing. and he was good to his word. Well, no, he didn't have to. It didn't pass. It failed by two votes. But I think part of that failure was the strong backstop that he provided last year against that particular voucher program. And it's interesting how context has changed a little bit. He's still a backstop, but different bill, different proposal, different measure.
I guess the problem here is, though, is that if they don't accept amendments in the House,
mm-hmm.
and it goes to conference committee, and that's where the real, excuse my language, fucking loose problem is.
that's where they're really let me say this, there's a lack of transparency in 100%. Conference committee. There's a lack of and that's not just for the public, that's for members of the legislature as well.
You mean they've been lying to us this last decade about Republicans operate the most transparent government in history?
It is nearly impossible to discern what happens. Yeah. In any given conference committee, it's nearly impossible to discern what happens and how a product comes out of it. Senate doesn't even meet. There isn't even a meeting. It's a folder that just gets walked around with signatures obtained.
The lack of transparency in the legislative process is horrendous. But even worse, and you touched on it earlier, is the lack of transparency and accountability that's built into all these systems. Because whether it's homeschooling, us refusing to even hold it to any kind of standard, we don't know what's going on there at all. We have no peek inside private school realm either. Yet we have this whole series of unbelievable scandals, whether it's Epic, you know, talk about private education. We talk about gear funds.
Yep.
You know, how do we know that people aren't going to take this fat check they get and instead of spending it on their kids' education, you know, they spend it, you know, homeschool-wise, for example. Yep. They buy more Xboxes or buy more TVs or go on a cruise or something like that. You just know. And I thought, you know, Republicans were always, we're going to be accountable for the taxpayer's dime, you know, and I just don't see it.
No, very, very little specification about allowable expenditures written into the bill. And there's a little bit, it's touched on, but it's, in my opinion, quite wide open about what expenses are allowable, especially on that homeschool version of the credit.
You know, one of the things that worries me the most about what could happen if this gets to conference committee is that a lot of it is going to be driven by something that rank and file Oklahomans who don't pay as close of attention to it as we do probably have no idea what's going on. And that is a speaker and a president pro tem who both are jockeying to figure out where they can move up to on the political ladder.
Right.
You know, whether it's governor or Congress or,
yep.
you know, whatever it might be, some statewide office. Yep. And so, I mean, to me, that's about the only thing that the only reason that I can see that the McCall has so dramatically shifted positions this year is the guy wants to be governor.
I think there's that. And I think I would also state that, you know, you can have this kind of like strong arm authoritative approach when there's a supermajority. When there's a supermajority, this is possible. And that is a nonpartisan statement. If the mm-hmm. supermajority was Democratic, this same situation would be possible. When you have a healthier or a more viable minority, you simply can't get the votes you need to behave in a very strong armed, authoritative way, strong, you know, heavy-handed way. And I mean, I might say to anyone who's frustrated with that, well, I mean, look at the imbalance in our legislature.
Yeah.
I've never been one to say that Democrats have all the answers. Far from it. Far from it. But you know, on the Senate side, when you have 8 of 48, how would you not expect matters to be handled in a very heavy-handed, authoritative, kind of my way or the highway manner? And I've forgotten the breakdown on the House. All right, I think they got 20 Democrats mm-hmm. out of 101. Yes, when you have an imbalance in numbers like that, yes, you're gonna have authoritative approaches to solving problems, maybe even problems that don't exist.
Yeah, I mean the carrots and sticks that are you know, yeah. given to the majority, members of the majority, right? Like the compliant yeah. majority. You know, and it's been this way for what, at least 10 years that I know, because that's as long as I've yeah. been back. But you know, T.W. Shannon, you know, gave everyone a committee chair. He created committees, and there was like all these new committee chairs, and that's yeah. how he kind of settled down his raucous hard right, you know. And then yeah. I mean, the same thing kind of happened with Speaker McCall as well. So, anyways, yeah, I mean, and then we know that happens with Senator Treat specifically. You know, we saw it last year after his voucher bill.
We saw it on the floor. We saw it. It was out in front of everyone. On display for those listening, during the 1647 bill hearing on the floor. I love that term, compliant majority.
Mm-hmm.
Because it, interestingly, wrapping back around to on the issue of public school funding or defunding, the rurals weren't compliant.
Yeah,
they were part of the majority in a partisan way, but you know, party affiliation, but they were not compliant on that matter. And now there's this sort of like, there's this eerie compliance.
Mm.
And I wouldn't call it healthy.
But it makes you wonder what's up, right? Like yeah. what is coming that may yeah. explain it, because there is so much at stake for their yes. districts.
And you know, I've said it before, I'm an urban senator, don't pretend to understand rural problems at all. It's not my job. I've got, you know, urban problems yeah. and urban you know, urban matters that I represent. But it's when the rural voice becomes silent, that is a big problem. That's a vast, vast stretch of Oklahoma and a lot of Oklahomans whose voices have been silenced when yeah. the rurals are not speaking up.
The precariousness of their economic status to, you know, just like the lack of economic development in the rural parts of mm-hmm. Oklahoma, it's that much more perilous for them
yeah
to be silent.
Yeah. So yeah, that compliant majority. Yeah. There have been a couple times throughout this session, whether it be on this particular matter, the, you know, the the tax credits or other entirely unrelated matters, I'll be sitting in a committee room and no questions from majority, no questions. And, you know, I'll pull up the mic again. Here we go again. Okay, I'll be the Republican in the room now. I'll look around and I'll think in my head, gosh, I'm being a better Republican than about six of you right now. Get it together and start questioning your leader. Start questioning your party members in power. Because that compliant majority, that's going to stick with me. That's a topic really to ponder, I think, and how a compliant majority isn't necessarily good. You know, it doesn't really speak to the best interest of our state. We need majority members asking questions.
Yeah, my suspicion is that they're really getting the screws turned on them, you know, behind closed doors. And I don't think they're lazy. I don't think they don't, you know, no. don't have the best interest of their districts at all. Like, I don't think any of us think that, but I something else is afoot.
not lazy at all. Some of the hardest working and most skillful and finest legislators you'd ever meet. Strong individuals who always speak out in the interest of their districts. And there was this deafening silence this last round. Maybe in a way this session in general, but then it really became obvious on the when we heard 1935.
I can't help but wonder if they're just happy to watch Speaker McCall twist in the wind, you know, and take advantage of his threats and make them, when it comes back to his chamber. And, but I don't know, we'll see. So,
yeah, it's like, I think I said before, you know, depending on your perspective, it's kind of exciting, maybe a little bit frustrating.
In a sort of nerdy way, right? We're all like, what's going to happen?
Yeah. I will stay with the line that this is not a good way to use the people's time.
Absolutely.
And it does create an atmosphere of uncertainty. You know, are they going to invest in public ed or not? Mm-hmm. Is there going to be a raise or is there not? You know, teachers trying to make future plans based on finances, make decisions about their lives and their jobs and their families, and not really knowing if they're going to have any extra resources to do that. And forget about the extra resources that could potentially go into public schools themselves, which would improve teachers' lives at work while they're trying to do their job. Mm-hmm. But so with all that hanging in the balance, you know, no, overall, this is a good way to do things. Doesn't inspire confidence.
Arnold, anything else?
Well, we could probably beat this horse a while longer. I guess what I'm, because there's a lot to beat there, but you know, I just can't help but, wonder if lots of folks have just sort of checked out of the system and just figure what will be, and there's nothing that they can do about it at this point. And I'm afraid that if this thing just rolls on through this session, like it appears that it will in some form or fashion, that it's not going to be until parents are unable, the school doors can't open because they don't have enough teachers, the buses can't get the kids to school, that people are going to wake up and say, what the hell happened? And it's happening right before their very eyes. It's a slow motion train wreck right here, and we're seeing it. And the consequences are going to be dire for a generation or more in Oklahoma. It will take a long time to solve, if we ever do. And particularly in rural Oklahoma, public education, it may be gone out there, and with it, the economic hopes and prospects.
And it's not like there isn't precedent for that, right? New Orleans public schools, for one. I mean, there is a precedent for everything going charter, or it's not unheard of, so it can happen,
right. I just got chills. I think it's slow motion train wreck, and also what happened in New Orleans. This is not a good outlook. I hope that in the back and forth game that is going on now, I hope some good comes out of it. There's a lot of good in it. There is a lot of good, particularly in 2775, not at all in 1935 in my mind, but I hope that some of this good prevails. And like you were saying earlier, that maybe we come to the conclusion, wait, why do we need both? Why do we have to have both? Mm-hmm. Why can't we just say, teachers, you're worth it. You're worth it.
Gosh, what a shot in the arm would it be, right? Like if this was the only thing that got signed into law this year.
Yep. We'll see. I'm watching just like you are.
Yeah.
I am not in those rooms just like you are. And sitting there trying to figure out what's going on.
Well, thank you.
And our listeners, and I think they know that the reality is you have a voice and you can raise hell mm-hmm. with the legislators on this thing. And you ought to.
And yes, absolutely. Now we're going on and on and on. My office should have been overcome with contacts about these two bills. It was like crickets. And yeah.
We talk about turning teachers out for a walkout.
Yeah.
I mean, I think parents, we're the ones that really need to step up here, you know? I mean, teachers are parents of school children as well, but it's just like, I don't know.
The parent choice folks were there in a rally on Thursday. So they were there in force. I don't know what happened to, you know, the ones in support of 1935.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what happened to the other side there. Anyway, just not any criticism at all. Just wondering. Wondering what happened to the rurals? What happened to the, you know, to your traditional pro public ed folks? What, why the crickets around this 1935? I had my trusty, you know, faithful folks who always contact, but there wasn't an outpouring this time. I think somebody said earlier checked out. I wonder if folks are checked out, tired of the games.
Honestly, and they adjusted the schedule too with deadline week being after spring break. So I wonder if like the usual advocates are kind of discombobulated with that. But is like this is supposed to be like the lull, right? Until the next
day.
But anyways, that's not an excuse. So I don't know.
So many questions.
Yeah, thoughts. Thinking about things. So yeah. Well, Senator Dossett, it's a pleasure to talk to you today. Since this is the first time we've had the chance to have you on the podcast, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the Friday afternoon with us. Valuable Absolutely. Information and insight. So, we can have you back.
Oh yes, absolutely. I've been in podcasts, and I saw y'all one time at the coffee shop where you did sort of like a back and forth discussion. I love all your programming. You do great work. So glad to be a part of it.
Glad to hear that. So thank you
so much. We'll schedule you to begin cutting commercials next week.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so you know.
Very good. Awesome. All right. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
Take care. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ObserverCast. If you like what you hear, please tell your friends about us and share our episodes far and wide on social media. If you're interested in sponsoring ObserverCast, please give Arnold Hamilton a call at 405-478-8700 or drop him an email at ahamilton@okobserver.org. You can also support ObserverCast with a tax-deductible donation to the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation, whose mission is to help create a better, more informed Oklahoma. And to help keep us on the air, visit okobserver.org and click on the Donate button on the upper right side of the homepage. We also urge you to subscribe to the Oklahoma Observer, now in its 55th year of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. We have a special digital subscription rate for ObserverCast listeners, only $1.99 a month for the first year,
That's 50% off the usual rate for monthly digital subscribers. Just use the coupon code ObserverCast when checking out to get the discount rate. And finally, we want to thank Jared Deck for the music you're listening to in the background here. He's not just a resident of Norman anymore. He is now the Oklahoma State Representative for House District 44. Congratulations, Representative Deck. We're so proud of you. But you can still download his albums at iTunes and learn more, including dates for any upcoming performances at jareddeckmusic.com.